And they weren't worth keeping anyway.
Did you keep a personal diary?
No.
What did you do when you were on leave, or were you ever on leave, I guess?
Yes, I was on leave while I was in the States.
Okay, this is side two of our interview with Gene Aldridge, and he's talking about what he did when he was on leave.
Of the 4 years in World War II, 2 years were overseas. So my leave on Hawaii was to take in the sights and tour the island, you know, and do that type of thing. But my wife, while I was in the States, my wife was with me for about a year of that time, and she traveled with me for about a year after I got commissioned. And then after that, I was on the move too much, and she went back to work in the defense industry. But I would go to some USO shows occasionally, and if we were in an area where there was a theater, I would go there. That was basically it. I loved to dance, but I didn't dance with anybody but my wives. So I didn't go to their dances usually, yeah.
What were those USO shows like?
Well, some of them were really good. You know, I saw Bob Hope in Hawaii, and he had an excellent show. And but I think I only went to probably three or four of those, and but they were high-class entertainment. They were Hollywood stars or people that were talented, you know. So I would enjoy that. And I would go to a movie when I could. And quite often, we would get up a ball game, basketball or baseball, or even if it was in a sandlot, we would get it up and get the gear that we had to have to play it. And I would participate in those when I could. On Okinawa, I was umpiring. After the war ended and before we went to Korea, we organized a baseball league, and I was an umpire in the baseball games over there. So it varied.
Were there any other memorable experiences that we haven't mentioned yet?
Well, most of my really memorable experiences were of the Korean War. I think we've covered pretty much my experiences in World War II. Korea was a different scene entirely, and that's another story, yeah.
Okay. What did you think of the officers or the fellow soldiers?
It was a big mixture. Some of them were, my superior officers, generally speaking, were very good and very competent. But we had exceptions. And we had one commanding officer that none of us felt was competent, and he was relieved of his command on Okinawa. Other than that, if there was incompetence, it was probably on the lower level, lieutenant or something like that. And that wasn't critical, you know. And basically, some of the troops didn't like their COs, but it didn't seem to make that much difference in their performance.
What were interracial relations like in the military at this time?
My experience with people from other countries, primarily, There were very, very few black people in our outfit, very few. There were, though, a lot of the unit I was in had was based on a National Guard unit from California, from the valley, and there were quite a few Portuguese and not Mexican, but Spanish people in that unit. And I got along with them fine. And I had pictures of all of them individually, just their faces that I have in my album at home. And that would tell you really what the mixture was there. But I never had any problem associating with them or getting along with them. And I never had any of them that were really rebellious of following instructions. Now, Korea, I was closer to black people in my unit that I commanded, and that's a different story, though, yeah. That was the Korean War. See, I was in Korea twice, from Okinawa to Korea in World War II, and then back in 1951.
Do you recall the day your service ended? What were the circumstances?
I was interviewed in, I think it was Camp Stoneman, California, Northern California. And basically the interview was, do you want to stay in the reserves? And my answer was no. And the fellow said, well, now, you know, if there is another war, and if you're recalled, you'll go in as a private again. But if you want to retain your commission, you can stay in the inactive reserve, and you don't have to go to a meeting, you don't have to wear a uniform, you don't have to do anything for 5 years. But if you're recalled, you'll come back in as a first lieutenant. And I thought, gee, I don't want to start out again as a private. And if I don't have to do anything, and now I'm 26 years old, and at the end of 5 years, I'm going to be 31 years old. And so I said, okay, I'll stay in the reserve. Well, that was a mistake. About the time or the 5 years was up, I got a telegram saying that due to the Korean crisis, your reserve time is extended indefinitely, and you may be recalled to duty. And I was. And that, I felt the Army violated their agreement with me because they had said 5 years, and it was after 5 years before they called me back. But that's what I remember about my separation of service, yeah.
So what did you do in the days and weeks after your service ended?
I went right back to work in the bank. Well, maybe a short vacation. I don't recall. My wife and I may have traveled a little bit, but basically I went back to work in the bank. And I was still a teller. I had started out as a messenger, and then I got to be a bookkeeper, and then I got to be a teller. And I was a teller when I was drafted. Well, I had never had any authority, and I never had any responsibility, really, in my life. But in the military, after I got commissioned, I had both. I found out I had both. And so, in retrospect, I think the military was very helpful for me, because now when I went back in the banking business, I felt much more confident of my ability to do things. And as it turned out, I ended up in my banking career as being president of an independent bank for the last 8 years of my banking career. And I give the military a lot of credit for my being able to do that, because I only had a high school education. I didn't have a college education. I had a lot of courses, college courses, while I was in the banking business. And I did graduate from the Pacific Graduate School of Banking at the University of Washington, but it was like a correspondence course type thing. I went up every 2 weeks for 3 years, but in the meantime, I did correspondence work. But I did graduate, but that was my highest form of education. So I feel, I can't say that I was lucky, I was blessed.
So was that readjustment to, what was that readjustment like to civilian life?
It was quite easy, really, very, wasn't traumatic at all. I went back to work for the bank. My wife was still working at the time. And within a matter of, 2 years, we started having a family. And we had three children. My first wife and I had three children. And we bought a home and did the things that families do and worked out really good. But that was after the Korean War. That wasn't during. No, I'll take that back. That was between the wars. That was between the wars. The Korean War, she came back here to Hayward. Well, that story that you saw, how I got her back here and then flew and went back to Korea. So it was after World War II that we bought a home and had two of the three children, yeah.
Did you make use of the GI Bill?
No. Never took any benefit from that at all. I was too old to be go back to college. My wife had been waiting for 6 years to have a family, and I didn't want her to have to work anymore. And I just decided I'd stick with my banking career and make the best of it.
Did you make any close friendships while you were in the service? And did you continue?
Yes, yeah. I had, in our medical detachment, there was a young doctor, and I say young because he's about my age, from South Carolina, Doc Page. And he and I became really good friends. And he taught me, anytime he had an interesting diagnosis or a case that he felt was different, he'd call me in and explain it to me and show me, tell me what to do about it and so forth. We also had a dental officer, a Dr. Hall from Minnesota, Ken, and then there was a chaplain that I was real close to. He still lives in Goleta, California, this chaplain, and I correspond with him regular, or Christmas time anyway. But Dr. Hall was killed in a plane crash. And I lost track of Dr. Page. I was on a motorhome trip and called him, and he was leaving for Europe the next day, so we didn't have a chance to get together. And then I found out he was moving to Raleigh, North Carolina, and so I lost track of him, and I feel badly about that. But yes, there were other officers in my unit that I got friendly with and got close to.
Did you ever suffer nightmares or flashbacks when you returned?
No.
Do you feel you took part in the post-war economic boom, and in what ways?
Well, I moved up in my banking career from a teller to a manager for the Bank of America. And then I went to work for another bank as a manager, and went from there to vice president, regional vice president, senior vice president. Most of it had to do because I'd had so much experience in the banking. In every phase of banking I was in, I was from a teller, I went to be a loan officer, I went to be a branch supervisor, all these promotions really helped me along in my career and eventually ended up being a president of an independent bank, the Bank of Irvine, for the last 8 years of my career.
Did you, or did your military experience influence your thinking about war or the military in general?
No, really didn't.
Do you feel like your military experience influences you politically in any way?
Yes, probably does. I feel, for instance, that the war in Iraq and the war in Vietnam were wars that had good intentions. We wanted these people to experience democracy as we know it. But these people are probably not ready for democracy. The Vietnamese, we were too far away to conduct the kind of war we tried to conduct in Vietnam. Too far and too difficult for us to do that. In Iraq, I think our intentions are of the best, but I don't think we ever contemplated that those people would kill themselves to avoid democracy, and that's what they're doing. They're killing each other because they don't want democracy to take hold, and I don't know what the solution to that will be. If those people who want democracy are strong enough, they'll probably survive. But it's taking a terrible toll on them. The toll on our military in Iraq, to me, is really very, very small. We're talking about, I think, 1,800 killed and quite a few more injured. But compared to our other wars, it's very incidental. But I don't know what the solution would be, and I sure don't have one. I'm just hoping that those people, there are enough of them and they have enough backbone to resist this and overcome these terrorists that are killing so many of them. And that to me worries me. I worry about that. When the war started, I felt that it was a mistake. That we had never really started a war before. We'd always gotten involved. Even Vietnam, there was a war going on and we got into it. But now we really started that war, and I didn't feel that we should do that. Then after I read more about it and read what the intentions, our intentions were in going in there, and what we were planning to do was to go in, get that ruler out of there and his group, and have the people take over. But it didn't work. And now I'm not sure that it wasn't a mistake. I'm just not sure.
You mentioned you credit the military in many ways for teaching you responsibility and that kind of thing. Is there any other ways that you feel the service and your wartime experiences have affected your life?
I don't know. I really don't know. My Korean War experiences had more effect on my life than World War II did.
And how was that? We can go ahead and go into that.
It's the first time I ever rebelled against my superiors. And I actually requested a court-martial. which probably was very foolish. But I felt that the punishment, I had just been recalled and hadn't been back in for more than 2 months when I got that traffic ticket, and the commanding officer was going to make an example of me. And while I was guilty, I did exceed the speed limit. It was 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was going 60 in a 45 mile zone, and I got a ticket, and I was guilty, and I was prepared for a reprimand and a fine. But when he started leveling penalties like restriction to the base, impound of my car, and all these other penalties, I felt it was excessive punishment. So I asked him if I could request a court-martial in lieu of company punishment. And he said I could, so I did. And that's when the next day I got my orders for Korea. And I went back to Korea in 1951.
Do you ever watch today's war movies?
The what?
Do you ever watch today's war movies?
Once in a while. We don't have a theater here. Mm-hmm. And so it's very difficult for us to go, and especially Edith doesn't get around that well. But I saw Saving Private Ryan, was it? Yeah, I saw that. I thought that was an excellent movie. Very good. And I saw The Longest Day. Those are two that I recall seeing. And every once in a while, there's a short one on, well, like on D-Day and Armistice Day and places like that, they have flashbacks. And I have several books and magazines about that I look at occasionally. So yes, I still am interested in warfare.
What are your thoughts on the way the war is portrayed in those movies?
Saving Private Ryan, I thought, was kind of far-fetched, but it was an interesting story, and it was fiction, and that part of it's all right. I don't see enough of them and enough different ones to be influenced one way or the other, but I can't help but feel so grateful to the combat soldier. For every combat soldier, you've got to realize there's probably 10 or 15 who are not combat. Service organizations like the medics and the quartermaster and so many of them. But all these people support the combat guy. But supporting them, to me, doesn't entitle us to a lot of privileges. So many, some organizations seem to feel that if you wore the uniform and you were in service, that you're entitled to special privileges. I've never felt that way. I felt we just did what we were supposed to do, and if we did a good job, fine. But I don't feel I'm entitled to any privileges. I've never taken advantage of the GI Bill in any way. And I don't know that my brothers ever did. Because we just felt, but if you were in combat and you were fired at, or if you were injured, or whatever, the government does owe you as much as you can get from them, period. And I have a friend who was in the Seabees and was badly wounded, and it took him a long time. He now has 100% disability, but it took him a long time to get the government to recognize that. And those are the people that I want to be sure are taken care of. And these organizations like Disabled American Veterans and all, I question how their money is used, because the government, I think, takes pretty good care of those people. And how much of the money is contributed goes to administration and solicitation and all, I don't know. And they never tell you. So I don't really, I am a member of the American Legion and the Veterans of Foreign Wars, but I've never been active in those groups.
How might your life have been different had you not served in the military?
I don't think I would have been nearly as successful in my banking career if I hadn't had the military experience that I had. I credit my service a great deal for my success there.
A few years back, Tom Brokaw wrote a book labeling your generation.
Yes, I have a copy of it, yeah. I've read part of it, yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, his background was so different from mine. He was born and raised in South Dakota, and it was on a farm, as I recall. But his family life was completely different from mine. We children never really got to know our dad. He was gone, I would say, two-thirds of the time, making a living. He didn't abandon the family, but he had jobs. He was on the railroad, and he was a circulation manager for a big area of South Dakota. He had these various jobs that took him away from home. So my mother really raised us, and he talks about their family and the things they did together and all. We never did those things. We never had a birthday party at our house. We never went on a picnic together. We didn't do any of the things that he said he did and his family did. And most of it was because we were just poor. We wore hand-me-down clothes, hand-me-down shoes. Everything was used until it was just falling apart. And we didn't have our own toothbrush. We didn't have, we just didn't have a lot of things that most families have if they can afford it. And it was because we were so poor. And my mother and dad worked so hard, and I know they loved us, and they worked so hard to support us, but they just didn't have time to play with us. I played basketball and football in high school. They never came to see me play. They never came to any of our plays in school that we were in, even if we were featured in them and all. It was just a kind of a different upbringing entirely. And I feel bad, especially. See, my dad died when he was 52 years old. And my mom lived, and she was 89, so she lived for 40-some years after he passed away. But I was gone as soon as I got out of school. I was gone, and I only came back to visit. I never came back to stay. And I feel blessed. I've had, I think, a successful career. I've had two beautiful wives. I have fathered four, and she has fathered four, but we only have seven, yeah. And we've had a wonderful life, yeah. No regrets.
What about Brokaw labeling your generation the greatest generation?
Well, I think that's a little overemphasized. I think that we all did what we had to do, but most of us weren't heroes. We answered the call. We did what we were asked to do. Fortunately, our leaders got us through it and direct us in the right areas and all. But I don't think of us as being heroes, most of us. Like I say, the combat soldiers, you bet. They get everything, all the kudos that they can get, they deserve. But the rest of us who just served are not all that great.
Well, that's all my questions pretty much. Is there anything you'd like to add that either I didn't ask or we didn't get covered in this interview?
Well, yeah, about the only thing I would say is that the people close to us who stayed home and did their jobs at home don't get enough recognition. My mother had 6 boys in the service, and the only recognition I think she ever got was that the Des Moines Register had our pictures. Did I give you one of those pictures?
Not
I didn't
yet.
Give you. Well, maybe you don't even want one. But the 6 of us in uniform with my mother's down below saying she's waiting for the mailman to deliver her mail. My mother, my sister Edith, my wife who stayed home and worked, those people made sacrifices too, but you don't hear much about that. Don't hear much about that. That's about the only thing, my only observation is. There were other heroes and heroines that didn't get recognized that much.
Okay, well, I want to thank you for helping me out with this,
well,
Gene. And
I hope it hasn't been boring.
Not in the least. Hopefully, this is something that maybe we can pass down to people in your family and in next generations.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, Adam. Well, it's been kind of fun. You know, I like to reminisce, and the stories, some of the stories I've told you about the big urn and the typhoon and, you know, and but most of the ones that I think are interesting were happened in the Korean War because they're so different. They're so different from World War II was just kind of a moving on the scene, you know. But not Korean War was different, you know.
Sounds like a future project in the making. Well, I'll go ahead and end the interview, and
okay.
This will be it. Thank you.